Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
For months, Labour have been hammered with questions about what they stand for. Well, now we know.
It's change. It's time for change. Change the change into the change that you want to change. Change. I'm Nish Kumar, or my friends call me Change.
You're David Bowie.
Change.
And I'm Coco Khan, and this is Pod Save the UK.
To chew through a big week of manifestos, we're joined by political journalist Zoe Grunewald. Hi, Zoe.
Hello.
Hiya.
Later, we'll also be hearing from some very special guests. But first, let's hear Keir Starmer at the launch of the Labour manifesto.
We can guarantee for every young person a job placement or apprenticeship when they're out of work. We can invest in their mental health, their physical health, their dental health. We can reform the curriculum to prepare them for their world. We can create new youth hubs to give them something to do in their community. Raise their wages if they're at work. Give them the power of the vote. Tackle injustice with a new Race Equality Act. And with our mission on clean power, we can lead the way on climate. Finally, show our responsibility to their future, a fairer, healthier, a more secure Britain at the service of working people, with growth from every community, a Britain ready to restore that promise, the bond that reaches through the generations and says, this country will be better for your children. That is the change on offer on July the 4th.
So some of the kind of headline pledges, no new taxes on working people, building 300,000 homes, 2030 ban on petrol and diesel car sales, a new border force, 40,000 more NHS appointments, House of Lords reform, an ethics body for Parliament. Zoe, sort of broadly, there were no surprises in this manifesto. This was all very heavily trailed.
Yeah, there were no surprises. And Keir Starmer said when he was launching the manifesto, if you want theatre politics, collecting on seas, very nice this time of year, as right. in pointing towards Nigel Farage. He was saying, Britain want a serious leader who's not going to make all these wild promises they can't keep. You all want security. You want to be able to trust me. So, you know, there were no big spending pledges. There were no rabbits out of the hat.
Do you think that the fact that everything was trailed before was to prevent a sense of shock about the plans? Or actually, would that never have happened? Because ultimately, the plans are quite conservative. It's a cautious manifesto.
It is a cautious manifesto. I also think there is value in trailing them beforehand. It gets all that scrutiny out the way. It gets all the big questions. It allows them to road test their policies so they know exactly what lines of attack are going to come up. Mm. They've known for ages, because they're the Labour Party, everybody's going to be asking them, are you going to put up taxes? Are you going to put up taxes? And so they have said categorically again and again and again, no, we are not going to put up taxes on working people. And it just makes it easier. Once you know what the broadcasters are going to ask you, what the Telegraph is going to hit you with, your line of attack is polished.
Isn't there something in the fact that in the actual speech that you gave at the manifesto launch, the word change is just on its own in the background, and the front cover of the manifesto is the word change. Is there something in just going, just anything else?
Like, absolutely.
This campaign is, we are just not those fucking guys.
Yeah, you guys want change. You're sick of this, aren't you? And they are. You know, I went to Warrington, right, on Tuesday, because Warrington is a really interesting town. It's two constituencies. One has always been a Labour safe seat. The other one has been a swing seat. So it was Tory in 2019. Before that, it was Labour. This time, it's going to probably go back to Labour. And I was talking to voters on their doorsteps. I was talking to voters in the town centre. Everybody everybody said, I am sick of the Tories. Mm. I'm sick of this. Nothing's changed. They don't listen to us. They don't care about us. A lot of undecided voters, a lot of people not sure where they're going to put their vote. Quite a lot of people saying to me, I need to check that Labour's plans are fully costed.
Yes.
Don't know if I quite trust Keir Starmer. I still yet to think about that. But definitely, there is a sense of just get them out. The problem is, when you campaign on a platform of change, you actually have to change things.
Right.
Yeah.
So you look at Labour's manifesto, a lot of it rests on being able to grow the economy. I'm not an economist, but that sounds to me like it's going to take a bit of time. People are going to be expecting something from Labour within the first 100 days. So they really have to deliver something that people can say that's made a tangible difference to my life. And I think that's the challenge.
Here's what Paul Johnson from the IFS reckons about Labour's manifesto.
What they say is they want to get the economy growing. Well, absolutely. That has to be the number one priority. And there's plenty in there to suggest that they're on the right track. Liberalising the planning regime, sorting out our regulatory regime, having some kind of industrial strategy, for example. But that's not certain. It takes a long time. And it doesn't obviate the need for making those choices between tax and spend, where we really didn't hear any detail.
So essentially, they're talking about austerity, more austerity, isn't that right?
Well, that's kind of the conclusion, because if you're not going to invest in public services when they're in the state they are in at the minute, if you're not going to put up taxes, if you're not going to borrow more, there are questions about those unprotected departments, those, you know, and that's things like the court system, that's things like local councils. What is going to happen to those if you are not generating revenue and immediately putting it in those systems? And I think Labour have said there will be no austerity. Keir Starmer said that quite explicitly in his speech. So the big question now is, does that mean if growth does take a long time, just as Paul Johnson was saying, all those things take a while to trickle through, can we expect wealth taxes? And Labour have, they've said our plans are costed, there's no need for that, but they haven't actually explicitly ruled it out. And so there are some people, and I think some people genuinely hope Labour might implement a progressive form of wealth taxation. That is one way you can drum up some revenue for public services, because I think a lot of people are worried. And, you know, the key thing is, if you allow the NHS, for example, to fall into a state of disrepair as it is now, every day counts. Mm. You know, more and more people stuck on waiting lists develop more conditions. Yeah. They get sicker and they get iller, and then they have more complex needs and the NHS is overloaded. You need to act quickly. And, you know, Labour knows this. So I don't think they are going to let the economy fall into a state while waiting for the magic bullet that is growth.
Yeah, I mean, they've also said that so far there's nothing about reversing what Jeremy Hunt announced in the March budget, which was spending cuts worth up to about £20 billion from government departments. Now, anyone who understands those government departments has come out and said that that will decimate large sections of the way the government is going to operate. So there is a tacit assumption that Labour will immediately reverse those, almost as soon as they come into office, certainly by the time of the autumn budget. It does feel like a lot of this manifesto is designed to be very cautious and, you know, very Keir Starmer in the way that it's packaged. And then there's this huge hinterland of spending cuts and wealth taxes that it feels like we're all supposed to be taking with a sort of big old wink at the end. Is that fair to say, Zoe?
I think so. And Paul Johnson, I think it was him who said, there's a conspiracy of silence over this from all the main parties. Everybody knows, every economist is in agreement that the way public services are currently being funded is not sustainable. Actually, recent polling has suggested the public is actually in favour of tax rises, personal tax rises, if it means that their NHS is functioning properly. So it's also not, you know, it's not the Labour Party's shtick to cut public departments. But, you know, I think there's equally this kind of this cautiousness within the Labour Party, which is like, we can't spook anyone now. We can't say tax rises. So it's a really, you're right, it's a really strange dance.
Well, it wasn't just the Labour manifesto we heard from this week. We also heard from the Lib Dems on Monday, the Tories on Tuesday, the Greens on Wednesday, and then Labour brought up the rear on Thursday. There's apparently some bullshit that Nigel Farage has scribbled on the back of some cigarette packets that I think is officially the Reform manifesto. But we are obviously on this show, because of our well-known interest, going to be largely focused on the Labour, Green and Lib Dem manifesto. I'm going to be honest with you, the Conservative manifesto, I mean, does not seem to be worth the paper it's printed on. It has proposed tax cuts that are supposed to come from a squeeze on the welfare budget that they have absolutely no specification on. It has been absolutely slammed by, amongst others, Paul Johnson, who we heard from earlier from the Institute for Fiscal Studies. So we're going to focus on the Labour, Green and Lib Dem policies from a national level.
Right. So in the Green manifesto, they've made a number of suggestions of ways to raise new revenue, including increasing the rate of national insurance contributions for those earning over 50k and closing inheritance tax loopholes. But the one that got the most attention was the introduction of a wealth tax, which, by the way, we spoke about in last weekend's episode with Gary Stevenson. Go back and check it out if you haven't heard it already. So perhaps unsurprisingly, the wealth tax idea went down like a lead balloon in the traditional media.
We don't want the ordinary householder to be affected by this. So it is very much the very wealthiest, the less than 1% of the population that have over 10 million in wealth and assets.
And it raises peanuts.
There's enough. 15 billion a year is what the wide variety of academics and experts we've engaged with.
No country with a wealth tax has raised anything like 15 billion.
Andrew Neil there, defending his mountain of gold, speaking to the Greens co-leader Adrian Ramsey on Times Radio. It's a relatively radical offering from the Green Party. There's the actual proposed policy is 1% annually on assets above £10 million and 2% on assets above £1 billion. There's also suggestions that were less focused on by the media, including a proposal of £90 billion of new carbon taxes. Is the Green Party actually going to be able to affect a drag on the mainstream of British political conversation?
It's interesting because there's actually been a lot of focus played on the Green Party this election, and that's because Labour has drifted further towards the centre or the right, however you'd like to put it. And therefore, there is more conversation about the Greens picking up support in various areas. There's suggestion the Greens could pick up maybe a handful of seats this time. Previously, they just had one MP, but we're looking at Bristol and Sheffield as potential places where the Greens could make gains.
All places that I do well on tour in.
There's some correlation.
Offer my tour sales up for my 2022 tour to the Green Party if they want to just map their campaign based on it.
The question as to whether two or three MPs on a good election result for the Greens would really push the conversation in Parliament in terms of policy. Yeah. There's also the Lib Dems, who have actually put quite a left-wing, I know we'll talk about their manifesto in a bit, but
yeah,
I think quite a left-wing manifesto out. They're that sort of lefty Lib Dem rather than the sort of NIMBY Lib Dem, which we've been more used to over the last few years.
Just to jump in on that, the Lib Dems are proposing closing the capital gains tax loophole, which they say would raise £5 billion, increasing levies on banks to raise £4.25 billion, an aviation tax raising £3.6 billion by targeting only the most frequent flyers. If we're saying that the Greens might only have a couple of MPs, the Lib Dems are going to have quite more MPs.
Yes, yeah. In fact, some polls say Davey could be leader of the opposition.
But how will he do that from the log flume? Where will he get the time?
I know. And, you know, I think if he thought there was a chance of him being leader of the opposition, he might have done some slightly more serious statesmanly media bits.
Are you saying there's a part of Ed Davey going,
oh God, I'm actually going to...
Shouldn't have worn the giraffe tie.
I'm actually going to have to do some work.
The day one of the campaign shouldn't have been me doing a sort of surfboard, paddleboard exercise.
So even though the Greens, just as a three, might not be that powerful in an alliance with the Lib Dems, with left-wing Labour MPs, you might see quite a strong left-wing alliance in Parliament.
That's going to be absolute catnip to the, no offence, hippies that listen to this.
Yeah,
that could be really exciting news potentially for the country, right?
Yeah, I don't want to make promises.
Yeah, I almost feel some glimmers of hope. Yeah, there, and I was like, push it down.
I'm like, am I actually being correct here? No, I'm pretty sure. No, there are definitely left wing Labour MPs who are I don't want to say biding their time, like they're going to blow everything up. But you know, they have demands. They have things they want to achieve. They have left wing progressive constituents who aren't happy with the state of the Labour Labour Party. Yeah. Mm. And you've got, as you say, a vocal Green Party and Ed Davey on his paddleboard. So a powerful coalition.
Business at the front, Arnie at the back. So now, after the break, we'll return to some policy areas that we've visited on the show in the past with the return of some PSUK All-Stars.
Okay, let's look now at one of the biggest issues the country faces, health. Our NHS is in an absolute state, waiting lists are spiralling, patient outcomes are worsening and costs are rising. It is the prickliest topic to whoever the next government is, brackets Labour. So the key pledge, Labour is saying that they'll cut waiting lists by adding on 40,000 more appointments every week, by incentivising staff to work out of hours and using spare capacity in the independent, which obviously they mean the private sector. Mm. The Labour Party historically has been more trusted with the National Health Service. I mean, how do you feel like this offering stacks up?
I think there are two broad concerns. Well, I'll start with the good stuff. There is genuine will in here. The problems for me are that Labour isn't really talking about social care. Mm. And I don't think you can be realistic about the scale of the problems with the NHS unless you're talking about the scale of problems with social care.
Yeah.
One of the biggest problems we have in hospitals is people, older people, bed blocking because they can't get back out into the community. They can't get community care. Because they're not getting care when they're in the community, they're ending up at frontline services, A&E, and blocking up A&E. So we need to radically rethink the social care system. To be fair, Labour is offering a fair pay settlement for carers, so that's a good start, but I think it needs to be much more radical. The other is, obviously, Labour's talking a lot about using private investment and private sector technology in the NHS, which for a lot of people is a warning sign. I think there is a point that the backlog is in such dire straits and that the Conservatives have allowed the NHS to run into such problems that it's hard to argue against having some private sector involvement to speed up capacity and to get through those waiting lists. The danger is if that becomes the norm and it allows the public side of the NHS to fall into disrepair. And that's where Labour have to ensure there's that trust.
But isn't there also a myth that the private sector is more efficient? Hasn't there been evidence that, in fact, they only take the easy cases and they only take the cases where they can make money from it? And actually, just in terms of delivering good care, it is better for everyone to be in the NHS.
And when there's profit margins involved, you know, quality of care reduces because that allows your profit margins to go up. I think it's desperately sad that it's got to this point.
Do you think it can work? I think is the thing I really want
to know. I hope so. I really do hope so, because I can't think of another solution apart from, well, massively raising taxes, which, you know, is to me isn't the end of the world. But I think people, if you did say, look, everybody's going to have to pay more in their national insurance because we need to sort out the NHS, people might go, okay, because we love the NHS, but how can you promise this isn't going to keep happening? And that's where you need to have a radical rethink about things like social care, which, you know, is only going to put more demand on the NHS until it's fixed.
And I mean, some of the concern around Wes Streeting specifically is that he's taken around £175,000 from donations from donors linked to the private health sector. And also, I don't know how significant this is, but Labour has dropped the phrase "the NHS is not for sale" from the National Policy Forum paper last year. Is that overreacting to something that's actually quite a minor rhetorical point?
I don't know why you wouldn't just keep it in there, to be fair. I don't know. I mean, Labour have changed their language around a lot of things and, you know, you can be cynical about it or you can be hopeful. I don't understand why you wouldn't keep that phrase. To me, it seems like quite an important one. Obviously, there are concerns about any prospective health secretary taking donations from private healthcare companies. It's unfortunately not uncommon, you know, it's part of politics. But yeah, absolutely, that is something that would be concerning. Labour have to win trust on this issue, right? They have to keep the doctors and the NHS managers and everyone on side. And I think that's a really difficult task.
I've said this about 500 times. People always lose interest halfway through because it's a really boring point. But it is one I think is really important and worth making. Every year since the NHS existed, more money has gone into it annually, right? Which makes sense because you have to put more money in because you're keeping more people alive. The Conservative Party for the last 14 years has been able to say we are putting more money in than at any other time in the NHS's history. But what they've done is cut the percentage increase that the NHS receives every year, which works out as a real terms cut. And I actually don't think Labour has been vociferous enough in making that case, largely because it's quite boring and quite a specific point that you have to make about the phrase percentage increase is never going to get anyone excited, apart from me. Let's talk about the other parties. The Greens have pledged an extra £50 billion per year. They say that they're going to increase the budget in England by £8 billion. The Liberal Democrats are actually only promising £8 billion a year for health by the end of the next parliament. So the Greens, again, making huge financial promises. The Liberal Democrats also, you know, pushing this idea on NHS spending. Ed Davey made the NHS a pretty big cornerstone of his speech around the manifesto. Again, are these things that policies that have put in place by two parties that know they're not going to be in power, but that in the life cycle of the next parliament, when allied with the left of the Labour Party, could actually have some impact on national politics?
Yeah, I think when you vote for the Greens especially, you're voting more for sentiment and values than you are for genuinely believing that they are going to form a government. So, you know, a lot of people will vote for the Greens in the hope that, as we were saying, that will help bring these issues, you know, to a national agenda, and that will mean that somebody's lobbying Labour to increase NHS spending. The point is, neither the Lib Dems nor the Greens really need their numbers to add up that much, because they're never actually going to be running the books. But what they want is, they want to send a message as to what they represent and what they would offer voters and what they can do. And actually, the way the Greens manifesto was phrased, it was, you know, when we are in parliament, we're going to be pushing on this. If we were in government, we would do this, which I think is quite a helpful way of couching yourself.
So let's just move on to talk about care. A few weeks ago, we welcomed journalist, author and social worker Rebecca Pierre onto the show to talk about the issues in the youth care sector. So that's young people that live away from their parents under state supported living. Rebecca was kind enough to share her thoughts on the manifesto pledges.
Now, when it comes to the care system, this has been largely overlooked by the majority of manifestos. However, there is one that stands out as the most radical and ambitious, and that is from the Lib Dems. So the first thing that stands out to me is the commitment to make care experience a protected characteristic. Now, people from care are hugely disadvantaged in so many spheres of life, more likely to end up homeless, in prison, less likely to go to university, and even compared to the average person, likely to die 20 years younger. So if put into practice, this would be a huge step forward, and it would mean that legally, people who have been through care could be protected from discrimination in the same way that you can on the grounds of age, gender, disability. Another thing that really stands out is a real commitment to tackle the root cause of children going into care, which often is poverty and children entering the care system.
I don't know about you guys, but maybe a bit surprised to see that the Lib Dems were the leaders on this.
Making people who have been children in care and making that a protected characteristic, that just seems like a free win for progressive causes, right? It is surprising that other parties haven't signed up to that. She was also keen, we should say, to emphasise that the manifesto pledges could have gone a lot further. When she was on the show previously with Lem Sisse, which is an episode I'd really urge you, if you haven't heard, to go back and check out, she talked a lot about profiteering in the private sector, and also talked about an end to children being sent hundreds of miles away to access care. Yes. And that being a huge factor in why life in care for children is often so difficult, because they're sort of wrenched away from the place they've grown up, and any support systems that they may have in place are taken away from them. But it's good to see at least it register with one of the manifestos that children in care are something that there should be some legislation around.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is slightly tangential, but some years ago I wrote a piece about childcare and how childcare really needed reform. And I remember talking to an economist who just made this observation that British people feel funny about welfare, and the issue around childcare and offering free childcare hours and an enhanced childcare offering, which we're now seeing. I mean, this was a few years ago I wrote this, and we are now seeing this conversation, was that it falls into this idea of welfare. And I do feel like it's just this dirty word in a lot of people's mind. Welfare is bad. Whereas obviously if you compare our Nordic neighbours, welfare is something to be proud of. It's something that's good, which I think actually let's generally talk about welfare in these manifestos. So we'll start with Labour. Organisations like the Institute of Fiscal Studies have said that while there is a bold intent to reduce poverty, there is a lack of specific and concrete policies specifically on benefits. One of the more surprising things is that there's no reference to any of the cuts of the past 14 years. So importantly, that's things like the two-child limit, the benefit cap and the bedroom tax. So these are all ones that the Labour 2019 manifesto pledged to scrap. So Zoe, what do you make of that, that they've just dropped those completely?
I think it's... it doesn't feel very Labour-y to not talk about welfare, I think. There's a lot of sentiment in Labour's manifesto. They talk about people, you know, they talk about joining up job centres and with career services, and they talk about, you know, getting people well-paid, valuable work. They talk a lot about their New Deal for Workers and how that would improve work. But those key welfare policies like the two-child benefit cap, like the bedroom tax, it is strange to not hear the Labour Party being bolshy on those, because traditionally that is the big fights that they've had with the Conservative government. The problem is, again, and it just keeps coming back to this, is that Labour just doesn't want to make any big spending pledges. And they just want to have this, you know, this growth agenda, and they're hoping that when the economy starts to grow, they can take action there. The problem is, the argument people are making is, what could be more important than lifting people out of poverty, right? And, you know, you can talk about making work pay, but poverty is a holistic thing. When you are poor, you're more likely to have bad health, you're more likely to have trauma, you're more likely to have, you know, addiction. It goes hand in hand with all these other ailments. Lifting people out of poverty could be the first step to making the nation healthier. So to me, it's disappointing, and, you know, I think I understand why they have to be fiscally responsible, but it is a matter of priorities.
So do you think, because there has been some positive murmurs, right? Like the one that's front of my mind is those horrific fit to work assessments. They're going to reform those, maybe even get rid of those. Those are so dehumanising. So those, that's good. So do you think the lack of conversation is more like they're keeping their cards close to their chest, and when they get in, then they can be like, ah, surprise. or actually, do you think that this is an issue that is simply too thorny and we shouldn't expect it in those first 100 days?
So I think when you look at the sort of people who in the Labour Party who are working on welfare and working on work, you've got quite progressive left-leaning members. So you've got Angela Rayner's doing the New Deal for Workers, you've got Justin Madders, Jonathan Ashworth. They're all, I would say, quite progressive MPs in many ways. And I think that Jonathan Ashworth, I think I'm right in saying this, did oppose the two-child benefit cap, for example. So I think you have the political will. I think you're right. I think there's worries about money. There's also worries that, you know, again, this goes back to the sort of slightly strange thing about British values and identity, that people don't like people they think don't do their fair share, right? They don't. There's always been this this demonisation of people who claim benefits, and that hasn't really gone away. So Labour always wants to put forward that it cares about people who are in the benefit system, but it won't tolerate people who don't do their share of work. And the reality is, it's far more complex than that. For
all the
reasons we were talking
about, universal credit are in work,
exactly. But it just makes it so easy for the Tories to jump on. You know, it becomes another political values hot potato.
It's so much of our political conversation is not necessarily dictated by what the public wants. It's just the more we talk about the Labour manifesto essentially having to dance between all these sort of, it's almost like they're sort of treading on a field and trying not to set off landmines around them. But these are all ideas that are actually popular with large sections of the public. And you realise like the extent to which our political conversation is completely shaped by, I'm sorry to keep returning to it, but just like these people who rage wank on the Daily Mail's opinion page.
Influential right-wing media.
Yeah.
That has always drummed up fears about benefit scroungers.
Scroungers, that's it.
Which is, you know, and it's such a naive view of poverty and deprivation and trauma, and, you know, it all breeds each other, and that's what the state's there for. It's supposed to be a safety net. It's supposed to lift people out and stop that cycle of trauma and poverty and deprivation from occurring. But it's so much easier for right-wing media to say it's just always going to be these people that do that.
Labour has also said it's committed to reviewing universal credit and wants to end mass dependence on emergency food parcels. We actually asked Helen Barnard from the Trussell Trust for her thoughts on the manifestos, and she did note Labour's commitment to end the need for those food parcels. But here are her thoughts on the Lib Dems and Green Party policies.
So we've had the first five manifestos, Lib Dem, Conservative, Green, Labour and Plaid Cymru. And we've been analysing them to see what policies could help turn the tide on the appalling levels of hunger and hardship we see across the UK. The Lib Dem manifesto sets a target for abolishing deep poverty in 10 years and a commission to recommend the amount people should receive from universal credit to ensure support covers essentials like food and bills. They also have commitments to improve social security for carers and build more social homes. The Green Party manifesto proposes a significant boost to social security and removing the two-child benefit limit with a rise in disability benefits, plus building more social homes. Both also take some steps to improve workers' rights. None of the manifestos so far mention local crisis support, which enables local authorities to provide grants to people struggling with unexpected costs and to fund advice and other preventative services.
Are we potentially talking about two parties that, again, with the left wing of the Labour Party, could create some pressure for pushing towards some of these more radical ideas?
And also, sorry, it's more that it's just so conspicuous of the absence of actual tangibleness from Labour.
Right,
like,
yeah.
There are actual things we can say about what the Lib Dems and Greens, and it still remains unclear to me what this dependence on food parcels plan and getting rid of it is for Labour. Am I right in thinking it's intentionally vague, which seems to be the theme of my analysis of the Labour manifesto?
I think it is. And I was listening to Peter Kyle, who is in the Shadow Cabinet, being interviewed after the budget. They were really quizzing him on benefits, you know, and welfare. And they were really saying, like, you know, why is this not a priority? And how is it the Lib Dems and the Greens outstripping you? Why is this happening? And he said, we want to do all those things, but we need to sort out the financial mess the Conservatives have left the country in first.
Yeah.
And I think that is the key. I think they just don't want to make promises they can't keep straight away. And I don't think they want the Conservatives to accuse them of, you know, mass public spending. And at least we know that the Labour Party doesn't have those kind of financial interests and that sort of level of corruption and the PPE contracts and the contracts for mates, all that stuff that tell you that the Conservative Party doesn't really care that much about sorting out poverty.
All right. Oh, wait, that's a weird thing to say. It sounded like a teacher. Sounded like Keir Starmer.
All right.
Yeah. Keir Starmer.
Everyone just pipe down.
Change those shoes. No running in the halls. Coming up after the break, we're asking WTF. I'm not going to say WTF, guys. I'm just not going to do it.
Okay, now it's time for the section that Coco refers to as WTF, and I enjoy calling WT fuck, much to the increasing chagrin of Coco. Just the strangest and wackiest election moments that are cropping up as this campaign rolls on into what feels like its 750th week.
Yeah. I would just say, just to have a little moment about this titling. I don't think we need to swear, and if any of our listeners can think of some alternatives, perhaps you can rebrand WTF moments to something more, you know, PG.
WTC.
No!
Wow, Coco. I don't think we should call them WT cunt moments. I don't think that's right. I think that's bad, actually.
Oh,
wow.
God. Because, you know, because we were talking a little while ago about, like, rebranding tax, and I was thinking, oh, we could just call it Cool Guy Fund or something and make rich people do it. Like, there must be some sort of, like, I don't know, charming and quizzical moments. What was that? You know, maybe this.
It feels
I'm
like we should have come
it,
up
right?
with this. At the moment, what we've said is, can some of the listeners do some of the
some
heavy
of our
lifting
work,
for
That'd
us?
That'd be great.
So, look, let's look at some of the strangest things that have happened in the campaign. First up, Keir Starmer barely had time to breathe in his manifesto launch before there was an immediate interruption.
Taken together, isn't this clear evidence of a changed Labour Party and clear evidence of the change we need for our country?
My generation is being let down by the Labour Party and this manifesto. You say that you're offering change, but it's the same old Tory policies. We need better. The climate can't
wait. We gave up on being a party of protest 5 years ago. We want to be a party of power.
He loved that, didn't he? He was like, oh, I've got a line for this. You could see he was like, oh, so excited. You must be familiar with that as a comedian. Like someone heckles you in a way and you're like, oh, do I have a zinger for you, my friend?
Yeah, I'm not sure any of them would have been transferable to Keir Starmer in that moment, as they are often quite obscene.
But I mean, like our jokes aside, you know, this protester did have a, I would say, valid point. And it was notable that essentially Keir Starmer's response, his prepared line that he said before, but is ultimately an attack on Jeremy Corbyn, isn't it? That's what it is. It's an attack on Corbynism. And he's had other attacks recently. You know, he talked about the Conservative Party manifesto as being Corbyn style.
When Starmer was interviewed by Beth Rigby earlier this week in one of the Sky interviews, she grilled him about Jeremy Corbyn and why he supported Jeremy Corbyn to be Prime Minister. And he immediately came unstuck. It was his weakest moment in the whole interview. And it was like, mate, you kind of walked into that. You don't you don't still need to be talking so much about Jeremy Corbyn.
It was a strange thing because he described the Conservative manifesto as being reminiscent of Corbyn's 2019 manifesto. And you sort of think it's a strange thing for you to bring up because you actively campaigned.
You endorsed it.
For that manifesto. Mm-hmm. You endorsed it. You campaigned for Corbyn to be Prime Minister. It feels like an odd rhetorical trap that he set himself.
Yeah.
And it's also not really the same at all in terms of policies. One's like broadband that we need as a utility and the other's national service and like more racism. Yeah. So not quite the same.
I guess in the absence of any meaningful opposition in this election, Keir Starmer has decided to have a fight with himself.
Yeah.
Which, if anything, we keep talking about him breaking with Labour traditions, but Labour fighting with itself is the most important tradition in the history of the Labour Party.
Well, you know, this has been a change in our usual episode, hasn't it? Because we haven't talked every moment about the Tories and their ranking competence.
Yeah.
It seems pretty clear that the penny's dropped for both the party and the public this week. However, we've got a new threat. The first Tory WTF we've got in this section is a poll that will send shivers down the spines of everyone, all parties. It's a YouGov poll for The Times on Thursday evening showing that Reform has overtaken the Conservative Party. Nigel Farage loves this. He was wheeling it out at the debate yesterday, talking about how they're the real opposition. I would just say, as we know from our lovely pollster, Joe Twyman, who came on in the last episode, that a poll is just a snapshot of time. Yeah. But nonetheless,
and also, as Joe raised, Reform numbers getting high doesn't necessarily correlate to how many seats they're going to win because it doesn't take into account that polling is spread across the country. And when you split that up across the various different constituencies, it actually means that, you know, they're still on course for getting maybe one, maybe two seats.
I know. And but, as much as I'm open to electoral reform, I'm like, first past the post, guys.
That is a very funny piece of, I guess, left of centre hypocrisy, which is we want proportional
but not for you.
I love first past the post. I've always said it. When it keeps Nigel Farage down, I love first past the post. It's the concern here, and I know it's very funny to imagine the demise of the Conservative Party. Sometimes it's the only thing I can use to get myself to sleep at night. But I would say the concern here is if we look beyond the 4th of July and the Conservative Party going into opposition, the wrestling match is going to begin for the future of the Tory party and the identity of the Conservative Party. And I don't think it's good for anybody or good for the country if the leading party of opposition has an undue influence from the far right of British politics. And the reason that that concern is sort of coming into focus is that Suella Braverman this week called for a closer working relationship between the Conservative Party and Reform. She actually said that Nigel Farage should be welcomed by the Tories and said that the Tories were a broad church and should not exclude anyone who wants Conservatives to get elected.
And maybe the Conservative Party dividing into two wouldn't be such a bad thing. Probably wouldn't be such a bad thing for Labour.
Yeah. But
yes, I think they're all very nervous about Nigel Farage because he's a provocateur and he likes to...
One way to put it.
He likes to wind people up.
I'm not allowed to say the other word. There is a way of putting it.
So Nigel Farage tweeted yesterday, tonight at Channel 4, on Channel 4 at 7:55 p.m, the Reform Party will release one of the most exciting party election broadcasts ever produced. I'm amazed it even got past compliance, but we did it. You won't want to miss this.
Now, I've not actually seen this, so I'm watching this live for the first time.
So what you need to, what is on screen at the moment is a slide. It's all black, and then there's text. It just says, Britain is broken. Britain needs reform. Mm-hmm. Reform is highlighted in blue. Now, what's very important to explain is that this slide is all of the advert. It is
what?
5 That's... minutes of just this slide.
Now, Nigel Farage likes to pretend that this is all you need. We don't do gimmicks. We know that all the British people want is straight talking politics. Britain needs reform. Now, if you looked at the Reform Party finances, you might wonder if they did actually have the budget to produce a full 5 minute comprehensive broadcast. That's all I'm saying. Well played, Farage, but I don't believe that that is actually what you went to the drawing board with and you said this is perfect.
Can I just check? Is it 5 minutes of silence?
Yeah, that's it.
5 minutes of silence. Obviously, no details on the policies, of course, no details on anything, just this strong message. It feels a little bit like, you know, advertising agencies, male dominated in the 80s.
Yeah.
And they're like, I've got a great idea. Let the tech speak for itself. And like, I remember seeing it being like, Britain is broken. I genuinely was like, yeah, my broadband's broken. Yeah. This is moving.
I'll tell you what this reeks of. This reeks of, there's no one in Reform young enough to teach them how to use PowerPoint.
Yeah.
Okay, let's briefly move on from absolutely unfathomable behaviour from the Reform Party to unfathomable behaviour from the Conservative Party. Rishi Sunak's Parliamentary Private Secretary Craig Williams is the subject of an inquiry by the Gambling Commission after he bet £100 that there would be a July election just 3 days before it was called. Here is what Rishi Sunak told Sky News.
Well, it's very disappointing news, and you would have seen Craig Williams say that it was a huge error of judgment. Now, there's an independent inquiry that is ongoing, which is necessarily confidential as well as independent, and you'll appreciate that given that, it wouldn't be appropriate for me to comment while that's ongoing.
But you could just clear it up. You must know whether he knew. It was a very tightly guarded secret.
Well, given the nature of the inquiry, which is confidential and independent, it wouldn't be right for me to comment while that inquiry is ongoing.
Oh my goodness me.
It's the worst campaign ever. It's the worst.
I just want one day of peace and quiet in the next few weeks.
Well, you know, crime is disappointing. That is true.
Also, it was a £100 bet with a 5x return. So he was trying, the maximum he could win is £500. Rishi Sunak's worth 700 million quid. Surely he could just start cutting his staff checks.
Yeah.
Craig Williams has apologised and said, I put a flutter on the general election some weeks ago. This has resulted in some routine inquiries and I can confirm I will fully cooperate with these. I don't want it to be a distraction from the campaign. I should have thought how it looks.
Yeah, you should have, mate. Innit? Yeah. So just to round us off with something surprisingly delightful, let's all listen to this.
Dawn Butler and Elson production.
Come on, 4th of July, don't forget to
We got 21 days to go. We got 21 days to go. If you like, let me know, let me have a shadow. We got 21 days, we gotta go. Wish you had D-Day, where we go? We say wish you had D-Day, where we go? Life don't let a liar run the show. Life don't let a liar run the show. If you like me, let me know, let me have a shadow. Got 21 days, we gotta go. 21 days to go. 21 days to go. 21 days to go. 21 days to go.
So that was a video from Dawn Butler, who is standing to be the Labour MP in Brent. It was a video saying there's 21 days to vote, using the famous song from So Solid Crew, 21 seconds.
I just want to make something absolutely very clear. We do not want this to open the door to more politicians rapping.
Really? Speak for yourself. I actually do. Don't you?
Well, look, as we record, there's 19 days to go. By the time you hear this, there will be 17 days to go. It's nearly over. Make sure that you register to vote by Tuesday the 18th, though I suspect if you're listening to this podcast, there's a good chance you've already done that in good time. Zoe, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And a big thank you to Rebecca Pierre and Helen Barnard for their contributions as well. that is it for the show this week. Now, while we wait for Election Day, we're going to be talking more about the manifesto pledges, and we want to hear your thoughts. So email us at psuk@reducelistening.co.uk or drop us a voice note on WhatsApp. Our number is 07494 933 444. Internationally, that's +44 7494 933 444. If you have bars, drop them.
Don't forget to follow at Podsave the UK on Instagram, TikTok and Twitter. You can find us on YouTube. There are full episodes there in colour. You can see our faces and everything. So drop us a review too, if you like.
Podsave the UK is a Reduced Listening production for Crooked Media.
Thanks to senior producer James Tyndale, assistant producer May Robson and digital producer Alex Bishop.
Our theme music is by Vasilis Fotopoulos.
Thanks to our engineer Ed Gill.
The executive producers are Anishka Sharma, Dan Jackson and Madeline Herringer, with additional support from Ari Schwartz.
And remember to hit subscribe for new shows on Thursdays on Amazon, Spotify, Apple or wherever you get your podcasts.
And send us those WT cunt moments.
Oh my God! How did it get worse? How has it gotten worse?